You're listening to a podcast from 702.
This hour, we are in conversation with one of the country and indeed one of the continent's most well-loved actors. He is absolutely amazing, full of humanity, full of energy, and already has several decades of brilliance behind him and still continuing with incredible consistency. And I'm talking about the one and only Jamie Bartlett. And I've seen on social media over the last 24 hours how many of you were anticipating and looking forward to this profile interview that we're going to have with him this hour. Show him some love. You can use the hashtag Bartlett with Eusebius. You can also just call in and say, how's it? Ask him questions. He is almost an open book. 011-883-0702. And we're just really going to spend some time with him and kick back a little bit because we can, and because he's awesome, and because we can do with, as I said, a respite from some of the horrible other things that happen in society as well. Jamie, I love you to bits. Thank you so much for coming to the studio.
Oh, you see me. San Banani Nong to everybody. And you say it's wonderful to be on you, so thanks for inviting me.
First and foremost, how's your son?
Muntu is in great shape. He's got one more year to go in Edinburgh. And I find him, he's a bag of tricks. And Dad, being a parent is tough. And it's the best thing that's ever happened to me.
I wanted to start there because every time over the years that I've had conversations with you, bump into you when Melville was still Melville, you without fail, regardless of time of day, will reference your lighty when he was still in school, before he pursued even his degree in PPE, although sadly I think he became more numerate than philosophical in his specialization. And so just reflect on that for me, because amid all the madness and the hurly-burly of being a creative, and we'll talk about your stage work, your film career, yes, your acting, being a dad has been a really important disruption and addition to your life.
Wow, yeah, that's the one thing that just... It's such an umbilical connection one has with a child, and as we've kind of worked through the various stages of him being a boy, a young man, and now a 22-year-old man, he's, you know, those conversations and the way that I've felt and the way he's made me feel on that engagement has been unlike any other engagement in my life.
Mm.
Hectic.
I stalk you. I talk to you whenever I can, or when we bump into each other. It doesn't matter where we're going, we need to be in conversation because you absolutely love dialogue. And I thought one thing I want to really get into conversation with you about is around the construction of a life and the construction of such an incredible career. The first time I did a profile interview of you was now way back in 2007, actually.
Yes.
So that was a long time ago. And I've watched you being interviewed by many folks over the years, and one thing that you keep on saying consistently is that what keeps you going is that you have the remarkable ability, when you're on stage, when you're rehearsing for your parts on telly or film, to actually take joy in the daily grind, that being an actor that defines who you are, that there's no existential crisis. Oh, my God, what must the next decade be? Must I now become a lawyer? Should I become a director? Mm. What is it like to have that kind of conviction that you are fundamentally an actor? And if that sounds like a weird question, let me pad it this way, Jamie. I still struggle with the idea that I could be a broadcaster for another 20 years, because the idea of doing something that I love, and even if I'm good at it, consistently the same thing for 20 years, it gives me a little bit of an existential crisis.
Yes. You know, I know that you love cricket because I listen to so much of your work. So I play each ball at a time. Mm. I'm going to play the ball on merit. I love waking up and charging in there in the dark to work, being in a state of preparedness and present, and just playing the stuff and engaging with the scene and where it needs to leave the audience at the end of that scene, and then breathing oxygen into the next scene and where that scene, how it serves the whole. And I really don't think much further than ball by ball. That's just Jay. That's the way I do it. Is that wrong?
No, it's not wrong. I think there's something incredibly exceptional about that attitude towards what defines one's purpose in life and sense of deep joy that you derive from being an actor. Because we live in a society where, and in an era where your child at the age of 22 is going to have multiple careers over his lifetime, unlike dad did. Yes. And so to still have someone who can, with that kind of consistency, wake up and get a profound joy from a certain kind of routine is for me absolutely remarkable. But I wanted to always ask you this question, and I don't know whether we've gone here before. I also find it fascinating how when you are in your character, whether it's David, whether it's Mike, whether it is your stage work, whether it's the incredible range of roles you have performed in film, that you do a kind of what I would think of as a double consciousness. You are inside the character, but you are also, with your incredible physicality as an actor, profoundly aware of what you are doing. So that if you, for example, need to get up slowly out of the chair and let your body be dramatic, you can see yourself from the outside, but you're still inside the character. Are you ever scared of going on the brink of madness?
I think it'd be fair to say that this character, this particular character, has lived very close inside me. And there is definitely a kind of madness, and I have to work consciously on snapping out of him. He really has colonized kind of every cell inside me. So my engagement with him is super quick. I know exactly where he lives, and I know how his water lies, and I'm very quickly into his mercury in the morning.
I would say this character, we're talking about David.
I'm talking about David, more particularly than other characters. But I do find when I was doing Death of a Colonialist on stage, I was also walking around with him, and it was, it was taking its toll on me. When I did that last character, I lost 15 kilograms.
Wow. That's a very good diet. I must change my career. That is incredible. That is absolutely incredible. Can we contrast David, though, with Mike O'Reilly? Yes. You remember years ago I asked you how you'd felt about Mike. And many South Africans may not be aware that although you were excellent at Mike's portrayal in Isidingo, there came a point where you resented the kind of stereotype of what Mike was projecting. And as I watched David in Rhythm City, I think to myself, but there's some ways, especially now that we, knowing what we now know in terms of masculinities that are healthy, I wonder whether there's going to come a point where you also think, just like some of the racial bigotry in relation to Mike O'Reilly, like some of the hyper-masculinity around David is also going to annoy your reflective self. Because for you, Mike O'Reilly, although an interesting role to portray, it caused you a lot of consternation, I know, offset.
Indeed, and thank you for that. That's, you know, you well met there. Gennaro, I try to bring a lot more woman to him. He has hyper-masculinity, but he's also got a very feminine side. I find him a much more complex character. And I think that hyper-masculinity is often well met with a very big femininity as well. So I really try to paint those two sides to make him very interesting. And I see so much of that in life. Yes. Hyper-masculinity is often joined by the feminine as well. So I try to paint that in the character.
You are hyper-masculine until you see Idris walking through the door. And you're like, oh my God, my water's going to break. And then all that hyper-masculinity just goes through the window.
Absolutely.
Excuse me. I want to go back a little bit to your childhood. How much do you feel any kind of English roots? Or is it all just when you get drawn into early life with dad and with mum and places like Maidenhead? How important are they to you in terms of your inner emotional landscape? Are you thoroughly South African and it really is just Wikipedia that will tell us that Jamie Bartlett was born in England?
Yeah, I think, well, you know, at my dad's funeral, so much part of my childhood was, my old man says, follow the van and don't dilly-dally on the way. Off went the van. So that and darts playing and porter pools and kind of Rondebosch East and the wrong was very much part of my childhood. And the songs and the rugby songs and the naughty songs and the dirty songs about, you know, and this is number four and we're rolling on the floor. You know, all of that stuff, it's there. But I'm an insanely, I'm a South African, you see, but it's, you know, right down to my twinkle toes, man.
Why do you often talk more? I want to ask you two questions here. You often talk more about dad than about mom. And secondly, I follow your career very closely because I love you so much.
Yeah.
And the other thing you do, although maybe this is self-explanatory, but speak into it, you also talk about dad's disability a lot. I've even heard you draw connections between the disability and how you find what you refer to as the Achilles heel of a character, and that it's memory of dad and dad's disability that also comes into your craft.
Yeah, as an actor, you're always looking for the Achilles heel or the disability of a character, his psychological disability, where he's nailed, where his flank is exposed. You're always looking for those grips. That's what gives the character dynamic. Just, I'm so aware that I look to my dad's lens and how his disability informed so much of him.
Yeah.
His generosity with people, there was nothing Dad wouldn't do to assist anybody. All of that, I think, was sourced in his own disability, and it had a profound effect on me.
Let's go to the lines. Uzi, good morning. Let me not hog the floor. Welcome to the show. You want to speak to Jamie?
Good morning, Mr. Eusebius and Mr. Gennaro.
Good morning.
How are you guys today?
We're very well. What question do you have for him?
I have a question for Mr. Gennaro, and my question is, how does it feel to be the bad guy on Rhythm City, even though I love you so much in your acting?
You know, I've only really played bad guys. Bad guys have a very particular role in soaps. It's like the J.R. Ewing of Dallas. It's a very prized role to play the bad guy, because you often get a lot of the lines. You're running very interesting A storylines, and you get wonderful interactions and character arcs. But to be David Gennaro is, thank God, people separate Jamie from David. Even though they call me David, they realize that I'm not a psychopath. I'm just playing one.
I wanted to ask you whether you do, because you're incredibly humble, whether you do your craft justice. Playing a bad guy as opposed to a guy who is not a bad guy,
yes.
What the difference is from a technique point of view. And in a sense, I've sometimes heard you even saying verbatim, if not near verbatim, that playing a bad guy is fairly easy in one technical sense, whereas the kind of moral complicity of a different kind of character means that you've got to dig in different kinds of ways. But I mean, just talk me through that. There must be it isn't just one dimensional. You wake up and you project your inner David and you leave your house and you go off to go and be formed.
No. But Gennaro's got so much bullshit going on. There's always a lie covering another lie covering another lie. So it's so multi-layered. We know that he's speaking nonsense to his wife. We know that he's calling his daughter with an ulterior motive. So every scene has got so many things stacked up in favor of the actor playing it. When you're playing a leading, good-looking man and you're walking through without any of these vices, and you're taking us through a 90-minute moving picture, it's quite difficult. And being a good-looking lady playing a leading woman or a man is often a more difficult task than the obvious villain.
You grew up in Pinelands.
Yes.
Your mom worked, and I'm not saying you never do speak, because you honor how incredibly hardworking she was.
Yes.
For you to be elitist and to go to a prep school.
Yes.
But you know, we live in a country that is often race reductive.
Yes.
But there's an interesting class element to your childhood in Pinelands. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, maybe this is not the language that a child would have. I think you sometimes, tell me whether I'm overstating how you felt, sometimes felt a little bit like an imposter, a bit of a English chav whose family's working hard for you to go to a prep school, and you are with all these incredibly other kids that come from very rich families. And mom and dad were often not around, which is why you read ferociously, even though you were a naughty kid at the same time. What was your childhood like? And did you ever feel like an outsider, even at your school?
Absolutely. And the polarization of what was going on in my little home in Pinelands and what was happening to the majority of, it was a boys' prep school, of the guys in my class, it was just two different worlds. And I often felt that, you know, coming from Pinelands and running into kind of, you know, that suburb of Newlands where Western Province Preparatory School was, it really was, you know, you were poking the hymen and sort of getting in there every day.
I want to play a little bit of a song. I think you probably will guess what I'm going to play. You know I was going to do this. But I want to play the song. I think of this song as my song and Jamie's song. It's our song. And my favorite memory of interviewing Jamie was now many, many years ago. And when I played this song, which I know is a song that is one of those artists that mean a lot to Jamie. You almost went into a trance. You don't need to recreate the trance-like state when I first played it. But my partner gets sick of me because I play this song at least 2-3 times a week. And without fail, when I play this song, I think about the first time I interviewed Jamie. It is such a special song. Just close your eyes. Just enjoy the track. And we'll play a little bit of it, maybe not all of it, because the clock is moving. And then I want Jamie to reflect on why it is that David Bowie is so special to him.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom.
8, 7, 6.
Commencing countdown, engines on. Check ignition and may God's love be with you.
David Bowie.
Yeah. You know, when in the apartheid South Africa that we grew up in, it was really a castle lager box. It was just bone-crunchingly coffin-like, boring. I was a boy who was really looking forward and wanted to interrogate. And when I saw David Bowie cross-dressing and wearing makeup and those outfits and the theater and the kind of the way he sung and the way he moved and kissing Mick Jagger and just doing cocaine and so blasted and so out there, and the fact he just let the line go and just said, I'm going to jump off this mountain, as he did, and all those genres of music that he entertained and went into, it was just, I needed that. He really informed me and was so welcome, especially in the kind of late 70s South Africa.
So you got permission?
Yes, I got permission. Like, hey, you know, I also want to do this.
That is absolutely stunning. Absolutely stunning. The other thing that happens to me when I listen to that song now, because of our connection through that song, it's our song, is the other thing that is a key part of you as a person. And I don't know how many people know this about Jamie, if you make the mistake of stereotyping him through Mike and David. Jamie is a teddy bear. You are always 5 minutes from crying.
Absolutely. I live in that presence, and I try and be there where I'm at that nipple where you're just so... I'm connecting with the work and connecting with people and connecting with just that soaring song. I'm just moments away from the emotion spilling and or not.
How much of your excellence as an actor is, in small part at least, if not large part, due to your ability, despite what we tell boys and the way in which we raise them, to allow yourself to take effect seriously as an artist and as a human being first and foremost?
I think that's absolutely critical. Absolutely critical, what you've just said. And, you know, I've really tried to take that on and try to make my emotional landscape as big a well as it can be to draw on, but only to draw all the time.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Diana, good morning.
Yes.
Hello.
Hello.
Go right ahead.
Hello,
talk to
Diana.
Is that Eusebius?
It's Eusebius and Jamie.
And Jamie. Well, my name is Diana Thompson. I don't know whether the name means anything to Jamie, but I used to attend to him in rugby matches at Bryanston High with the first aid. He was quite a tough little guy and was always getting injured. He was at school with my oldest son.
Do you
remember Thompson's at Bryanston High?
I certainly do, and I certainly remember your face. Thank you.
Do you?
Yes.
Jamie, I don't know if you were aware that Michael Thompson, my second son, you were with Alan. He, sadly, was murdered 11 years ago.
I'm sorry,
but the reason for my call is that his son, believe strangely to us, we didn't think he would, you know, ever do that, but he's got to a drama school in Somerset West. He's now 19, and I believe very talented. And I just wondered whether you had any tips for a young, talented guy. What should he concentrate on most?
Let me redirect that question before we take a break to news headlines. How does one know whether a lighty is talented or should be told to go and study actuarial science?
Ironically, a lot of people that have the marks to study actuarial science, for instance, the University of Cape Town, also want to become actors. So it's often you get that group, and they've got to be very, very careful not to start picking all these bright people. Often the person with the biggest emotional landscape is better suited. I would say the man must work incredibly hard. And just one bit of advice. In order to be an actor, you need to be extraordinary in order to have a career. You can't be a mediocre GP, a mediocre archie doing square toilets, in a suburb near you. You can't be a mediocre lawyer pushing property papers around. In order to be an actor with a career, you need to be extraordinary.
Absolutely. Mm. If you want to say how's it to Jamie Bartlett, give us a call on 011-883-0702. We're doing a profile of the man, his work, his life, and the incredible gift that he has been for us on the screen and on the stage, television and film across the continent, and plenty more for us to talk about in terms of what he gets up to, how does he actually chill, and everything else in between.
Eusebius Makaiza on 702 for the curious.
Yes, and we are hanging out with Jamie Bartlett, one of our most well-loved actors and one of the most brilliant who's been in the game for decades and does amazing, amazing things. Here's a question from Twitter. This is one that Jamie gets very often, and he still answers it as if he's being asked it for the first time. So I'll ask him this question. Mkize wants to know, Jamie, I have a feeling Mr. Bartlett doesn't limit himself to the script. Surely some of his lines are from his natural artistic genius. We are so lucky to have witnessed for so many, many years. Can he just talk a little bit about language?
Yes. So it's obviously quite difficult when you're using kind of metaphorical language. Like if I say I wake up in the morning, this morning I woke up like a sentry at his post. I'm using metaphorical language to say morning glory. And so I'm doing that all the time. I'm invigorating the language with metaphors, and I'm also playing a lot with rhythm, meter, hickory dickory dock, the tick tock of the ticking clock. I'm messing around with language, with rhythm, with meter, and that's something that I do in my dressing room, normally in the dark on my own very early. You can only break the rules when you know the rules. If you want to start improvising, you better know exactly what the rules and the intention of the scene is.
Were the scriptwriters initially annoyed, or were they just so amazed by your use of rhythm and language that they eventually simply studied you and now they script you?
They do script me. So, you know, he's got stuff like when he, you know, like when he says, on your bike, get out. Or do you want me to give you a running foot slap, bud? You know, he's got all these kind of things. When he talks, and a lot of English slang, like when he talks about his pocket, it's his skyrocket, or his mouth is his north and south, or his eyes or his pork pies. Those are all stolen from East End British slang. And I'm trying to really forge that into the work to make it detailed, to make people say, what did that guy just say? Yes, so I do work on that, and it doesn't anger the writers, but some of it can become quite obscure. And I've also been fined quite a bit from, you know, because some of it's quite naughty.
Mm. Can we go back in time again? Yes. I want to go to high school now. You were a naughty boy, and I love naughty people. That's one of the reasons I love you. But you don't need to love the school, and you don't need to be brilliant at everything at school. It takes one particular teacher. And it's amazing to me. It's often an English teacher. I don't know why it's always an English teacher, like Michael Staley. Or, in your case, also the weird combination of your rugby coach and Latin teacher, Tim Clifford.
Yes.
Just do a little bit of an ode to those teachers that really were important in spurring a love of literature, even of language. I mean, Latin is very important in terms of understanding how you became a cunning linguist. And people like Tim and Michael were important, even if the top line message is he got expelled.
Yeah, Tim and Michael, both of whom are alive. Tim's down in KwaZulu and Michael is here. They just kind of got me. They realized that I was absolutely in love with words. And that was the one thing that kind of captured me at school, is that I was appalling at kind of the application of mathematics and or biology or science. But when it came to language, reading, under the Shakespeare play, or understanding that the word con is from connect, conduct, conversation, conduit, confluence. And my word, is that how those words all work? That's incredible. I was so turned on by the derivative of words, and hence Latin, and Tim Clifford inspired that in me.
I find it wonderful, because usually it's in two different teachers that you'd find this kind of separate love affairs, one with language and one with rugby. The PT teacher would have to fight the Latin teacher for who will get more of Jamie's time. So Tim Clifford was lucky because he was your rugby coach as well.
But you
could have been a professional player. You played for Transvaal Craven Week.
I was a Craven Week player in 1983, Uppington, and very young. I played my first under-19 Craven Week game when I was 16 years old. So although some of those guys had 3 years on me in terms of musculature and growth, which at that age is a lot. And, you know, I had the opportunity to prop down against the great Springbok Guy Kibble. And he was weighing in at that time at Craven Week at 122 kilos. And, you know, I was a 16-year-old boy propping for Transvaal against him at 6 and 90 kilos. And that was, you know, it's just 25 kilos when you're a boy, it's just too much.
So classic dilemma.
Classic dilemma.
You get a sports scholarship.
Yes.
You turn it down to go into the arts.
Yeah.
How did you puzzle through those choices?
It was quite easy. I realized that I really wanted to be an actor. I realized that rugby rehearsals were in the evening at the University of Cape Town, and that I needed to be on stage in the evening, or working backstage in those days as a stage manager, or learning about moving sets, moving the flats, moving the Fresnels. And there was no way that I was going to give up studying being, you know, to be an actor at UCT, and rugby came second. It wasn't that difficult a choice.
I want to play a voice note. I'm not quite sure what it says, but it is from a very special friend of Jamie's and another South African who is just an absolutely stunning, stunning, stunning filmmaker, scriptwriter, and all sorts of other things himself, Craig Fredmond.
I think the reason that Jamie's such an extraordinary actor is that he has no fear when it comes to the proposals that he makes as an actor, especially in theatre, where you have that opportunity to explore moments and explore a scene in a slightly more in-depth way. The proposals that he will make are so unexpected and often outrageous and outlandish and often too much. But in that process, what he's giving you is a sort of depth of possibility that leads to something completely unexpected and completely special, as opposed to a first option or a second option or a third option that are relatively expected. He's coming at it from almost like a tightrope walker without a net. He doesn't fear failure. He doesn't fear embarrassing himself in order to make the most interesting proposal. And that is an extremely rare thing as an actor. And I think it's what makes him absolutely extraordinary.
Those are incredible words from Craig Fremont, who is, of course, absolutely brilliant writer, director, been involved in everything from Death of a Colonialist, Material, which is one of my now all-time favorite South African films as well. So to hear him honor you in that kind of way must be special.
Yeah. It's very emotional, and especially coming from my friend.
I wanted to just ask you about precisely Death of a Colonialist.
Yes.
And I've heard you reflect on that in many, many interviews.
Yes.
And when I see the footage of you performing on stage, there's a proximity, a physical proximity, and therefore an emotional proximity to the audience that's right there in front of you. It's very different to us being glued with pizza on our hands, sitting on a couch watching television. Experientially, how does TV and the stage compare and contrast for you in your relationship with TV audiences versus theater audiences?
There's that kind of invisible and difficult to articulate presence of people breathing with you. You can feel them exhaling. You can feel, you feel a connection that is an invisible connection of you being in the same room at the same time with them. And you can't stop. You can't say there's a technical problem. You can't. You're in there. Once you let that thing go, it just goes, man. Mm. And it's a big arc. The director's told you we need to be at certain points. The audience needs to be here. You need to ensure that. And you're aiming for that arc. That's the exit, and that's where the audience needs to be left. So you're working hard technically, and you're in a moment of extreme concentration to serve the work and to take the play along with your other colleagues to where it needs to be.
Craig makes being outrageous and outlandish sound great fun by using those adjectives. He also describes you as fearless. Mm. I know exactly what he means from a technical point of view.
Yeah.
But, you know, every time I see you perform, I see you engaging interviewers, I listen to you, I watch you, I think about your work, I can see the fearlessness, but I also think there's an incredible vulnerability in you, and that you have a kind of, in writing terms, Jamie, authorial control over it, but you open up those avenues of vulnerability. You tap into them. They are part of who you are. They are the reason why you get along with people. I saw the way you interacted with my colleagues beforehand as you were waiting for the interview around Johannesburg. We see it all the time, the kind of charity work that you do. What is it like to get incredibly high returns professionally and morally from that emotional openness when the stakes are incredibly high as well?
You're making any big proposal is you're opening up your flank to, there are big stakes because the proposal is big. If you're going to make a proposal that if the cleaning lady at O.R. Tambo wants to give you a hug, you give her a big hug. It's very close. You're engaging with her. You're engaging with men in insecurity or policemen on the side of the road or just an ordinary person is just walking up against you. If you're going to make that proposal, as I do,
yeah,
the stakes are high. And sometimes that kind of engagement is, it can leave you, your flank is exposed. What can I say?
We're going to take a break and then we've got about 10 minutes left with Jamie. There's so much more we can cover. We're going to start off on the other side of this break talking about one of his favorite love affairs, which is the cityscape and traveling. And we're going to talk about Jamie's Joburg, which is a passion of his. He is now almost 10 years due to honor a commitment he made to me. And I'm going to remind you what it was on the other side of this.
Eusebius Makaiser.
Eusebius Makaiser.
On 702.
You are a true African in the pan-African sense of the word. And even your engagement with Jozi as a city and the cityscape brings that out. If anyone has access to YouTube in 5-10 minutes, one of my favorite online clips is when Jamie with a friend hangs out and they go about Johannesburg and it kind of shows off the city to the world. Whether we're talking Joburg City itself, whether we're talking Yeovil, and just the incredible, incredible evidence of the possibility of a city that can be not xenophobic, more inclusive, and incredibly diverse, Jamie.
Thank you.
Can I remind you what that commitment was that you made?
Was it to take you to
Ethiopia? Yes! To take me away? Yes, and you never did, were you?
Of course I do.
That's exactly right. Exactly right. So talk to me about Joburg and why you love the city, whether it be Bria, whether it is even the madness of the criminality and the possibility of someone's freedom being lost. I mean, one can't glamorize the things, but you know what I mean. You've got a relationship with this city that for me is absolutely stunning.
I do, and I love the city very much. I'm in there probably 4 days a week in the city. My clothes are made there in London House. I eat Ethiopian because I love teff and jira at least twice a week there. I'm always in Bramfontein buying German bread in Judah Street. And I'm mad about the city, the colors of it, the palette of it, the smells, the textures, and the many, many cultures that exist within the city of Johannesburg, the CBD.
What makes these beautiful shirts that you have?
The various people that make the clothes, but most of the African dress, long shirt clothes that I wear are made by a Nigerian Muslim lady that's been making them for a long time.
Maria, what's
Maria?
What's Maria, yes.
Absolutely adore her. And that clip is on Jamie Does Jozi on YouTube. I'd love the audience to just have a peek at it.
David is so ubiquitous on the continent. It doesn't matter whether you are in Nairobi or Johannesburg, you are recognized everywhere.
Yeah, he has a hell of a big footprint and power in 20 countries in Africa, and that's where it's screened. You know, so I can't walk in Kampala. You know, Kampala exists of seven hills. I tried to do it one morning exercising with a friend. No, the audience is too big there. You know, because they recognize. He's really got to go incognito.
Lerato, good morning.
Good morning, Isirius. I just want to say that Jamie is not only a good actor, he's such a good person. He is such a son of the soil. I have an eatery in Love Day. He always passes there and have lunch. He's never too big for himself. He's such a comfortable, so true to himself. And I just wanted to say hi to a brother. Thank you.
Thank you, Lerato. And one of the reasons, besides the fact that you are magnanimous in the way that Lerato is describing, is the other thing. You made me feel like the rookie that I was as a late night talk show host the first time you spoke to me, because you were listening artistically even to radio about dialogue, the technicality, diaphragmatic breathing, how you frame issues.
Yes.
You take conversation and dialogue very seriously. I know that it is your humanity that opens you up to people, whether it be security guards, whatever the case might be. But you also have a deep, deep reflective love of the importance of dialogue and conversation.
Wow. And, you know, it's that conversation that makes me understand people, have empathy with people. That's very much part of my job, is that I know what their narrative is. I know what the narrative is on the ground because I'm engaging in conversation with many.
A couple of people on my Twitter timeline wants to know why it is. And it's amazing. People, again, this is a popular question. Given your artistic insights into your craft, why you haven't tried your hand at other ways of being involved, like directing and writing?
Well, I think the thing of import there is that I am an actor. I'm not a director, and I'm not a writer. I'm an actor, and it's that simple. When I see the breadth of what's required to be a director, I know that I can't fill those gaps, and so therefore I don't want to let myself down. I want to do what I've been trained to do and do it as well as I might.
A couple of shorter questions, because we only have 3-4 minutes left.
Yes.
How do you chill?
I chill. I like to cook. I like to eat. And I like to engage with anything with my mouth, like we all do. And, sorry, you see me.
Yeah, it's okay. It's okay. I love that. I know exactly what you mean. You also love traveling.
Yes.
Finding places, going to countries like Namibia, for example. You've been on a long trek there as well.
I've just come back from Myanmar.
Oh, wow. Tell me what traveling does to you besides being respite from the year end now.
It just makes me feel how small I am in the big world. It allows me into a totally different palette and culture of other people who clearly think differently about everything. And it humbles me.
Mm.
It really humbles me, and I just love that feeling.
Okay. So the next quick question.
Yeah.
How do you feel about fame? I have seen you being very kind with your time and being fully present with fans of your work, even at 2 o'clock in the morning in a nightclub. Doesn't it get annoying between us?
Fame is a burden, and it's all dependent on how you want to carry that burden. And I choose to do it in a particular way. And the times are few when it will annoy me. The times are many when I'm smiling through it because I'm enjoying the fact that I'm allowed to engage with people in this way.
Hmm. When you get back home or set after a long day of filming, what is the first thing you typically do?
A very stiff scotch.
The last thing is not a small frivolous question. Should have asked it earlier. I didn't know the time was going to catch us, but I know you will allow me to ask this question nevertheless. How do you deal with post-traumatic stress syndrome? The glasses that you have, people don't know the story behind it.
Mm.
You have seen things, literally war, Yugoslavia.
Yeah.
A part of what you tap into in your affect, your emotional depth with your characters, is that you've lived an examined life, and we are grateful for it because we benefit. But it also has psychosocial consequences, for one. And how do you deal with PTSD? Quite literally, that is what Jamie has to cope with.
I sometimes, when I start feeling myself spiraling out of control from a trigger, somebody in the dark knocking on the window very, very suddenly, being trapped in the car, the sound of anything that's frightening, anything that can trigger me, I break out in sheets of sweat, and I have to very carefully say, Jay, you need to get a grip, boy. You've been triggered. And I've got various mechanisms that I use to get it. Also, engaging with the character. When you're playing a role like I do, where a couple of times a year you can find a gun in your mouth. And in order to be present in that scene, it means you've got to engage. And when you're engaging on that level, it can trigger you. Mm-hmm. And I find that part of my work tough to handle.
Very last question. It's a 5-second question. I'm disappointed. I thought you were going to bring me a gift to make up for not taking me to the Ethiopian restaurant. And you know what I thought the gift was going to be?
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of Jay, I thought you were going to bring me Jay.
Jay, the perfume.
Yeah, what's happened to it?
Well, you know, that's kind of still on the burner, but it's funny I spoke about it, thinking that this would be a beginning, middle, and end. My word, to do something like that and to market something like that and to have a very big picture is a hell of a haul.
Jay Vilmos?
Jay Vilmos.
Jamie, I love you to bits. Thank you for your generosity. Thank you, man, for your excellence.
Yeah.
Always being humble and for all the work that you do with social impact and with so much humility. Thanks for coming in today.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you to everybody.